involving fears, doubts, worry, anxiety, and pessimism are unfortunately all too common. If children, for example, choose thoughts that diminish their self-image, they choose the consequences of self-doubt. If children think they'll do poorly on a test, then they probably will. An internal dialogue that is negative promotes failure. It can drown out positive messages that promote success. Simply put, children can do and think themselves into poor intellectual outcomes. There is also a strong mind-body connection. Every thought a child has engenders a corresponding change in their body. If a child thinks that a test will be too difficult, he or she will experience a negative physiological change. That change might take the form of a headache, stomach ache, nausea, faintness, trembling, sweating, bodily fluctuations in temperature, or other physical distress symptoms. These physical changes exact a high performance cost on their thinking ability. I once worked with a family whose 13-year-old son, Wayne, experienced test anxiety on a chronic basis. Wayne was a very bright boy with an above-average IQ of 110 who did well on homework assignments, but when it was time to take tests, he would panic and his test-taking skills simply fell apart. He was a C student with the potential to be an A student. Even though Wayne studied thoroughly, his anxiety level during test was off the charts. I deduced that his problem was not a lack of preparation, ability, or even motivation, but rather interfering and self-destructive self-talk. I asked him to recall and write down for me examples of what his self-talk was during his last failed test. Here is what he wrote. I'm starting to sweat and shake. What if I flunk another test? Everyone will make fun of me. This test is just too hard. I'm not smart enough to pass it. I should have studied harder. I'm such a wimp. My mom is going to be so disappointed. I just wish I could leave. I hate school. It should be obvious that Wayne failed the test because of this negative self-talk. Wayne is a very smart boy who, in this case, began the test with 100% of his mental horsepower engaged. But the effect of his internal dialogue was to cut his horsepower in half. Instead of maximizing his strong IQ of 110, he probably started the test with an applied IQ of maybe about 55. Was it any wonder Wayne, when in the test-taking situation, usually failed? His problem was that he was trying to do two things at once, listen to himself rag on himself, and at the same time take a test. Once the problem was diagnosed, Wayne learned to manage his self-talk the same way I'm going to teach you how to work with your children to manage theirs. His test anxiety was over and done with, and Wayne went on to become the excellent and steady student that he was always capable of being. The flip side of what Wayne experienced is the kind of internal dialogue that is positive, realistic, empowering, and above all controllable so it doesn't interfere during performance times. A positive internal dialogue can dramatically enhance intellectual performance. In a few minutes, when we turn our focus to self-esteem, I'll give you a powerful exercise that will help your child eliminate self-talk that works to his or her disadvantage. Next activity, practice controlled breathing exercises with your child. One of the most efficient and effective methods for stimulating a child's mental processes and performance is controlled breathing. On its face, this may seem like no big deal, but it is, in fact, a very big deal. Research shows that school children can increase their grades if they do breathing exercises prior to test or assignments. These exercises also reduce test anxiety. Controlled breathing increases oxygen flow to the brain, which in turn boosts memory, concentration, and problem-solving skills. The breathing technique I recommend is relatively easy to do even for a child, and you can practice it with him. The goal is to breathe out for exactly the same amount of time as you breathe in. This will work to prevent dizziness or hyperventilation. When you try this, teach your child to count to five when breathing in. and then to 5 again when breathing out. Repeat this breathing cycle about 6 times. The entire routine will only take a minute. Instruct your child to use this breathing exercise before a test, exam, or other assignment in which problem-solving or recall comes into play. Breathing patterns cannot be taught just once. They need to be practiced so that they become a positive habit. Remember, matching inhalation and exhalation time is the key. Next, increase opportunities for verbal interactions as a family. Engaging your children in conversation helps develop their language and vocabulary skills, particularly between the ages of 16 and 26 months, when a child's language is developing very rapidly. Studies suggest that the more talkative parents are, the larger their children's vocabularies will be. No matter what your children's ages, you should discuss with them topics such as school, friends, their interests and activities, projects they create, trips you've taken together, or current events. Make these conversations a regular part of life. What emerges from these interactions will be children who feel valued and are smarter, better adjusted, and more intelligent. With my own sons, one of my favorite word-building activities involved having them make up and tell a story about some topic. We would make it a game, and my kids' goal was to either make me laugh, scare me, or surprise me. The story had to incorporate each member of the family, including the 2 dogs, cat, a gerbil, and a lizard. And it all had to be included in a meaningful way. We always approach this in a fun, even silly way. For example, if Robin was involved, sometimes my sons would try to gross her out. If they could make her cringe, squeal, or grab her stomach, victory was at hand. The boys absolutely loved it. Disguised in this fun activity were a number of mental gymnastics. Jay and Jordan had to rely on their short and long-term memories. They had to deal with intertwining concepts and relationships, and they had to use their imagination and verbal skills. Encourage repetitive reading. It's no big newsflash that reading to your children helps nurture a love of language and promotes bonding, both of which optimize a child's intellectual potential. The latest word on reading, however, is that repeated exposures to a beloved book helps a toddler enhance his or her memory, improve attention span, and build vocabulary. If you have trouble getting your kids to read, try something that worked exceptionally well for a father I know. As a condition for purchasing a video game, he negotiated an agreement with his children that they could use it only on Sunday mornings, provided that each child fulfilled reading requirements throughout the week. This agreement proved to be a reliable motivator and even stimulated the kids to read more than they were required to. Create a stimulating environment. As a young child's brain develops, trillions of connections are formed between brain cells and develop through such stimuli as light, color, smell, and sound. These connections are vital to learning. The more connections a child has, the faster he or she can process information. Many experts believe that by stimulating an infant's senses through an enriched environment, you can quite possibly increase his or her IQ. Since I don't see any downside, I'd encourage you to provide toys such as mobiles that can be moved and touched, or colorful pictures and other objects that may help develop an infant's brain.
Many other ways to create an enriching, stimulating environment for your children are listed in the printout material under the heading 15 Ways to Create a Mentally Stimulating Environment for Your Children. Dr. Phil has set the stage for enhancing your child's functioning using intelligence as the working example. Now let's look at what you can do in some other important areas of your child's personhood, beginning with self-esteem.
Positive self-esteem is achieved through properly interpreting yourself through accurate, positive, and healthy internal dialogue. Let me be absolutely clear on what I mean. For many kids, self-esteem is measured as a function of what they accomplish or accumulate externally, particularly in the form of grades, trophies, recognition, or material stuff. But this form of self-esteem can be elusive, fickle, and completely vulnerable to the whims of the external world. When kids keep trying to meet internal needs from the outside that can only truly be met from the inside, they'll never hit the spot. True self-esteem is internally defined. It comes from the inside out. It means that you love, believe in, and accept yourself because you accept and appreciate that you are a unique, quality, and authentic person. These are all big words that children seldom understand. As a result, your emphasis must be on the result, not on the language to describe it. In children, true self-esteem, along with confidence, hope, and optimism, is generated by internal dialogue that tells children they are okay, loved, appreciated, and special. Positive and realistic self-talk also creates children who live up to their own expectancies, in contrast to those imposed by other people. Clarity of focus and cognitive efficiency are enhanced as well. Having high self-esteem and high self-confidence will ensure that those self-expectancies are high yet realistic and carry your children to their highest possible level of achievement and performance. If you suspect your child may be sabotaging himself with disruptive self-talk, you should work together to create a new, more accurate internal dialogue. The exercises you're about to do with your child are designed to help you do just that. Make changes internally to ensure he's accepting himself and therefore living with inner peace and confidence. Let's turn now to the specifics. First, help your child recognize some of these negative self-talk traps by asking him or her to write down or tell you the bad things that I say to myself. For example, I'm not good in math. I worry about getting bad grades. I won't do well on my test. Be careful to remain age-appropriate in discussing this with your child, or you'll just be talking to yourself. Children hear what they understand. Next, you can use a technique with your child called fact-finding to see if there is any validity to the negative self-talk. Ask, why do you think your thought is true or not true? Your child might respond by saying, I got A's and B's on my report card last time, so I do get good grades. I got a B on my last test. My teacher does say I'm a hard worker in math. The point is to help your child identify whether these thoughts are correct or incorrect. As you work through this exercise with your child, you may discover that a thought is true, such as, I'm a bad speller. Look upon this opportunity as a teaching moment. Ask your child, what could you do differently now to change that? Have your child come up with his or her own plan for improvement, such as studying a little longer or spending more time checking over assignments for spelling errors. When your child is involved in devising the solution, he has ownership in the plan and is better motivated to carry it through. As a way to eliminate any negative self-talk and build self-confidence, teach your child how to substitute and practice positive responses. Here are a few examples. I'll do the best I can, and that will be the best I can do. I studied hard for the test, so I should do well. I worked hard on my homework. I know my stuff. I'll be okay. I can do this. Finally, as you perform this exercise with your child, encourage him or her to express his or her new thoughts out loud. Research shows that working out solutions aloud helps in solving problems such as mathematics or understanding words.
In your printout materials, you'll find a section labeled My Best. This is an exercise you can do with your children. It is designed to help your children acknowledge their gifts and their importance in your family. Here again is Dr. Phil to talk about another important aspect of your child's personhood, spiritual growth.
You'll discover that as you establish a harmonious rhythm in your family and reduce the conflict in your home, your child will be quieter on the inside and better able to rise above the noise of the world. As this happens and your child matures, consider more spiritual topics. Spiritual growth or maturity is a complex and sophisticated journey, one that can go on the entire span of our lives. Even so, here are some things you can do to help your children begin to develop a deeper spiritual focus. Whether your definition of spiritual is a relationship with God or other concept of higher power, or simply transcending day-to-day existence. Create within your home the symbolism and ethics of your spirituality or religion. For example, use religious symbols as a part of your decor as well as in your practice of parenting. Practice your religion as a model for your child. Go to your church, your temple, mosque, or natural place of spiritual inspiration. Participating in spiritual traditions and rituals gives your children a sense of being part of something greater and more meaningful than themselves. Study the principles of your faith so your child can understand your role in it and choose to follow your values accordingly. Show your children that spiritual strength can be a powerful source of peace and strength. Pray or meditate with your child. Teaching children how to be still and listen to their hearts or to the depths of God will strengthen their sense of peace and integrity. There is one more piece to all of this that cannot be measured, scored, or counted, yet it must be taken very, very seriously. The love and nurturing you bring to everything I've offered here. Children who grow up in a secure and loving relationship with their parents tend to be smarter and more resilient. Of that there's no doubt. You can play all the word games you want with your kids, spend money on music lessons, work on emotionality with them, but none of it means much unless it happens with the right spirit. That spirit that says you love and value your children. The spirit that says you believe in them. When children feel this from you, they flourish.
So far in this program, Dr. Phil has given you the materials for building your phenomenal family. Why family matters. Special strategies for divorced and blended families. Exploring your family legacy and your parenting style. Now he's going to give you the tools. He calls these 7 tools for purposeful parenting. Here again is Dr. Phil with tool number 1, parenting with purpose. Define success.
One of the most important and exciting decisions you can make as a parent is to define success goals for your children. Success goals are tools that serve as guidance systems for parents and their children. Once you decide on the goals that will serve as the measure of your child's success, those goals will help you make decisions throughout the child's trip to adulthood. Choosing, communicating, and pursuing clear and age-appropriate goals for your child will give them a sense of purpose that brings them the experience of mastering their world as they achieve the designated benchmarks in their lives. It will also bond you and your child, bringing you together and energizing you both. Everyone loves success. A goal is different from starry-eyed dreaming of greatness and fame. A goal is realistic, it is measurable, and it can be clearly monitored day in and day out. It is a point of clarity in what are sometimes messy, noisy, and crazy lives. As a leader of the pack, your objective is to make sure you are parenting with a purpose. Your hands are on the steering wheel of the old Wally wagon. Your decisions must be guided by the plan and made as a parent who wants the best for your child. The only way you can evaluate the choices that confront you every day is if you know exactly what you want for your child. One of my goals as a parent is to help my children achieve their own goals while pursuing their own passions. I don't want my boys to just be another me, and Robin doesn't want them to be carbon copies of her either. They are two terrific young men, and we are getting great kicks out of discovering them and watching them grow and develop as individuals. In certain areas, I am so different from my two sons, it's hard for me to believe that we share any DNA at all. I am a softy when it comes to critters of all kinds. I am an all-creatures, great and small kind of guy. But I also realize there are legitimate and purposeful reasons for things like deer hunting, which helps control the herd population and prevents the weaker animals from suffering and starving. Still, I have no interest in shooting a deer. I'm no outdoorsman. My idea of roughing it is watching a big-screen TV inside a fully equipped RV. Nonetheless, I felt like I should expose my sons to hunting, fishing, and camping so they could decide for themselves if it appealed to them. For 10 years, I took the boys hunting. I intentionally never shot anything other than a can or a rock. But we had a lot of fun, and as it turned out, my older son Jay absolutely loved it. He became an amazing marksman and hunter, and he competes in a major bass tournament every year. Jordan, Jay's younger brother, turned out to be pretty much like me. He has no more interest in hunting or fishing than I do. That's okay. My goal was to expose them to things that might stimulate them, whether I was interested in those activities or not. A successful parent helps children find their unique gifts and talents. This may mean that you'll have to sit through recitals and soccer matches and muster enthusiasm for stamp collections and the complete recordings of the insane maniacs of rock. But I guarantee that along the way, you'll laugh and experience closeness to your child that will last a lifetime. And believe me, there is no greater gift you can give your children than introducing them to their life's passions. Benjamin West was a great American painter of historical scenes and portraits and was one of the leading artists in the 19th century. When he was a very young boy, West decided to paint a picture of his sister while his mother was out of the house. He got out the bottles of ink and started, but soon, no surprise, ink was everywhere. His mother came home to the mess and was not pleased, but before she could scold her son, she saw the portrait he had made. The mess was instantly forgotten in light of the beauty created. The mother picked up the portrait and declared to her son, "What a beautiful picture of your sister." Then she kissed him. Later in life, Benjamin West wrote, "With that kiss, I became a painter." Remember, your definition of success for your child must reflect your child's interests, skills, and abilities, not just yours. Wes' mother knew instinctively the importance of that moment, but we can't all rely on instinct. More and more, it's obvious to me that today's busy parents need to set specific definitions for success with their children. I was amazed at the results of the survey we conducted with the parents we polled from across the nation. 70% confessed they had no clue about what goals they should set for their children. Did you get that? 7 out of 10 said they had no clue. They claimed to be too busy to bother with planning. They were caught up in their jobs and the whirlwind pace of modern life. Some said their children set their own goals. One after the other, the parents we interviewed offered a multitude of excuses for not doing the most important job they'll ever be given. It told me something, too, when I saw that 25% admitted their primary goal was to create a teenager who would just stay out of trouble, grow up, and move out without scratching the furniture or denting the car. 5% said they had goals, but only in the vaguest and sloppiest terms, such as, "I want my children to be happy." Reading the results of that survey made me want to drive door to door across America, shake every one of those parents by the shoulder, and shout, "Wake up!" Obviously, we need greater dialogue about the incredible importance of setting well-defined parental goals for your child and specific steps for achieving those goals. My college football coach drilled that same sort of message through our helmets and into our thick heads every day before we left the locker room. "It's one thing to talk a good game," he would say. "It's another thing to do it." Before I get to some truly specific goals, let's define what I mean by vague goals. Take happiness, for example. As in, "I just want my children to be happy." I hear this all the time from parents, and it makes me crazy. Happiness is an emotional state. It's not a goal. Emotional states change with the weather, with your hormones, your bank balance, or the last episode of Friends. If you base your goals on an emotional state, I'd advise you to strap yourself in and keep your arms and elbows inside the roller coaster car, because you're in for one scary ride. And so is your child. How do you define happiness anyway? Is it warm and fuzzy? A belly laugh? A hearty chuckle? A satisfying feeling for a job well done? These are all good experiences to have, but they're not specific enough to define success in your child's life. Another mythical goal that drives me up the wall, the jaw-dropping concept of the convenient child. Time and again, parents tell me, "I just don't want any more problems with her." Having a convenient child who always does everything right and never causes problems is the last thing you should set as a parental goal, unless you're a Stepford wife. There is no such thing as a flesh-and-blood convenient child. When parents tell me that their child never causes any problems, two images come to mind: the robot or the quiet beast. The robot child makes no decisions for themselves. RoboKid only follows the rules while trying to hide from the world. What sane parent wants such a child? A child who never crosses a line will never experience an authentic life. A child without curiosity, a child without energy may be convenient, but that's not what you want. You want a child that is curious and energetic, a child who colors outside the lines as well as inside the lines. You want a child who is a unique being pursuing unique interest. The quiet beast is the kid who pulls the fire alarm when the teacher leaves the room. It's Eddie Haskell from Leave It to Beaver, or Beavis and Butthead masquerading as the Olsen twins. Every generation and every group of teens has quiet beast. In mine, it was the PK, the preacher's kid. The minister's daughter grew up bowing to her father's strict rules of conduct. She was required to be a convenient child to preserve his standing in the religious community. But when her teenage hormones started to rage, the quiet beast was unleashed. She broke every rule in the good book. Another myth that clueless parents have about goals for their children is that nature will take its course. This myth sometimes is translated also as, "God will decide what is best for my child." I've got my own translation. This myth is really about the parents refusing to take responsibility. Yes, there is always the possibility that a child will find his or her own path to an authentic and fulfilling life, but it is the parents' responsibility to serve as each child's guide and protector on this good earth. Responsible parents choose to take responsibility for their child's direction in life. You must determine both the path and the destination for the adult you are raising and prepare yourself to deal with potentially disastrous consequences down the road. As you learn more about your child, as your child learns more about him or herself, you become partners in defining success in life and in designing the plans for pursuing it. Until then, it is your job and you need to do it. Now, I'm going to equip you with at least the basics of a guidance system for parenting. It is based on the concept of operational definition of goals. Big words, simple idea. Parents need to discipline themselves before they can discipline their children. One of the most important parental self-disciplines is forcing yourself to move from the general to the specific. Rather than saying, I just want little Susie to be happy. You need to clearly define what sort of happiness you're talking about. Happy as in giddy with laughter, or happy as in living an authentic and fulfilling life. Whatever the heck it is, the parents need to define it so they can cut a path to it and know it when Susie's got it. Get it? Dr. Stephen Covey coined a good name for this concept. He called it beginning with the end in mind. That's exactly what you have to do. First, you decide what your destination will be, and then you look for the best route to get there. The second step in this process is to be able to articulate that destination and measure your progress toward it. It never fails when I try to teach this concept that some goofy parent will decide they aren't going anywhere. We just want to stay put with little Sammy. Their goal is apparently maintaining the status quo. They've given up on any higher aspirations for Sammy. They've decided he'll never be a National Honor Society member, or a McDonald's All-Star, or a Juilliard candidate. So they've adopted the turtle tactics. They are pulling all exposed limbs into the shell and just hoping that Sammy reaches the age of 18 without hurting himself or others. In other words, their goal is containment. This is also known as a not goal, and it's not a good idea. Any goal that contains a not doesn't work over the long term. Negativity is rarely a positive. There is no such thing as not doing something. The brain doesn't process negative instruction as a goal. Here's an example. Try not thinking of a blue elephant. Duh. When you set a goal of not doing something, it has no meaning because there's no way to measure that which is not present. Not being a drunk, not being a drug addict, not being a prostitute are not goals. So it makes sense to state your parenting goals in positive, declarative statements that can be objectively measured. There's another advantage to doing this. Clear guidelines make it much easier for your children to make their own decisions and in the process develop their problem-solving skills while using your criteria. If you were walking across the desert and you wanted to make certain that you were following the straightest path to the oasis and not going miles out of your way, you would instinctively pick out some palm tree or boulder to serve as a reference point, right? So will your children, as long as they're given a clear destination. And that is what parenting with purpose is all about. Parenting with purpose is a long and challenging trek. It's not a frantic mad dash. It's not about where your child's developmental progress stands this afternoon or tomorrow. It's about the type of adult your offspring becomes 10 or 15 years down the path. Getting to adulthood as a self-contained, authentic, and fulfilled individual with sound morals and values requires making thoughtful decisions step by step, hour by hour, while never losing sight of the guidelines or the long-term objective. One more thing. This process that you and your children are going through, it's called life. As difficult as it may be and as rough as the ride may get, I encourage you to savor every moment. Laugh together at every opportunity and always express your love for each other whenever you can.
Check your printout material and find the pages marked Taking Measure and Goals Worksheet. The first of these, Taking Measure, is a short audit Dr. Phil has designed to stimulate your thinking about goals you want to set for your child. When you finish the questionnaire, there's one more goal exercise to complete. That's the one labeled Goals Worksheet. This is designed to get your goal-setting process started.
As you go through these worksheets, keep this in mind. Goal setting requires more than wishful thinking. It is a daily monitoring process in which both you and your child participate. There will be times of absolute hair-pulling frustration as you miss some targets, and there will be times of jump-up-and-down celebration in which you delight in your child's achievements and growth. And you'll be surprised at how much you grow as well. Just by being an active goal-setting parent fully engaged in your plan for a successful child.
Tool number 2. Parenting with clarity. Talk, listen, and learn.
Most of us got our first lesson on the importance of communication from our parents as we were growing up. The good Lord gave you 2 ears and just 1 mouth. The not-so-subtle message of that old saw is that listening is twice as important as talking. Once again, an age-old parental catchphrase proves out, both practically and scientifically, and suggests a tool that must be employed if you're to achieve your goal of creating a phenomenal family. I'm talking about communication, including but not limited to the instructive kind that can be used for teaching, problem-solving, and raising your children in such a way that they'll become successful adults. The tool is based on the principle that communication between parents and their children is essential for building and maintaining a loving and productive relationship. As I've said, one of your jobs as a parent is to successfully socialize your child. If you can't talk to him in a way that he'll hear and hear him in the way he talks, you won't succeed in that socialization process. My objective here is to equip you with a working knowledge of how to connect with your child. To do that, you must know where the pitfalls are, and I'm going to show you precisely how to make this all-important connection through specific action-oriented communication skills. But first, before anything else happens, you have to get your mind right and approach this with a really good, open attitude, or we'll just be wasting our time by embracing hollow values. Having an open attitude begins with committing to be a good listener. Whether your child is 3 years old, 17 years old, or any place in between, you have to be willing to react to her point of view in a way that makes her feel good about having opened up to you. You can have just that effect by learning to really tune in and receive the messages sent. Think about it this way. Talking, seeking to convey a message, communicating in any fashion is a behavior, and all behavior is motivated. Whenever a child says or does something that is communicative, he's doing it for a reason. Rather than just listen to the words being spoken, you have to listen for the need driving the communication. Your child will only communicate with you if that behavior is being rewarded by you reacting in a way that the child perceives as meeting her need. You don't have to necessarily agree with what's being expressed because your agreement or compliance is very likely not the kid's primary goal in engaging you. In fact, as strange as it may seem, children of all ages tell us that often they don't expect or even want you to agree, concede, fix the problem, or give permission. Sometimes they just want to vent, to feel like they've made their case or just have you to talk to about things that are of interest to them. Whatever the content, they want to know that you think they're important enough to be listened to in a serious way. By the way, this is true for children of all ages. Making sure that your children see that they are being heard is extremely important to ensuring you will be heard. Children don't tune in to the message of their parents unless they believe that their parents truly hear and understand their concerns and needs. Kids don't want to hear a bunch of random preaching that you were spring-loaded to give before they ever opened their mouth. What they do want to hear and are willing to hear is your response to their position and message. The consequence of not responding to what they're saying, or more accurately, the need they're expressing, will be frustration, anger, and a relationship marked by resentment and disconnection. Shouting and slam doors or silence are pretty good clues that that is where you are. The good news is that the basic human need to be heard is so strong that a relationship can be renewed with improved communication. If you and your child are disconnected, it's not too late. Listening and really hearing and responding to your child is the key. Don't just go through the motions here. Resolve to genuinely listen and treat your child and his or her point of view with dignity and respect. turning off the television, stopping other activities, and giving your child your unhurried and undivided attention speaks volumes to your child about how important he or she really is. Children know the difference between real and fake. Now let's talk about some rules of engagement. Effective communication isn't just a free-for-all, and it certainly isn't a no-holds-barred argument with disrespect from your children tolerated in an effort to show that you're an enlightened and modern parent. It's important to set rules, guidelines, or boundaries for these interactions with your kids. My father's cornerstone rule was that I could talk until I was blue in the face, as long as I didn't get disrespectful. I could argue a point for hours to try to persuade him to change his mind or do things differently. He had let me go on until I went hoarse, but if my words, tone, or attitude became less than respectful, he turned me off, and he turned me off in a hurry. If that happened, I had no right to appeal. I learned pretty quickly to make my case like a lawyer in front of a no-nonsense judge. I think he even caved in a couple of times just to reward me for making my case in a respectful way, even if he wasn't fully persuaded. Just as my father policed my tone and attitude, you have to police your tone and attitude. You won't always get the response you want while trying to communicate with your children, but you must discipline yourself to keep trying to get your message through in the right way. Older kids are often self-conscious around adults, so they may appear to be inattentive or disinterested. But don't be intimidated or angered by eye-rolling and heavy sighs. If the child sits there and refuses to engage, that doesn't mean her ears aren't working. You'd be surprised how your words will be played back in her mind later. Often, teens just don't want to admit that their parents might be making sense, but they still listen. Sometimes you have to take what you can get. Just getting a teenager to stay in one place long enough to receive a message can pay huge dividends down the road.
In your printout material, you'll find a piece titled Rules of Engagement. These are some guidelines that can be especially helpful when you're trying to get through to a child.
Speaking of rules, it's important that you recognize the rule of reciprocity. If you are respectful, genuine, open, and candid with your child, he or she will be much more likely to treat you in the same fashion. You get back what you give. I know that can be really hard to carry off sometimes. Sometimes your children say things or take positions that are so outrageous we just want to go ballistic. Don't take the bait. Doing so only shuts down communication and makes the neighbors call 911. I'm always astounded when I see parents yelling, screaming, cussing, and even throwing things around during a disagreement with their children. I'm even more astounded when the same parent looks at me with a straight face and says, "My child is so disrespectful. He yells, screams, cusses, and throws things." Well, gee, you think? What do you expect? You get what you give. Remember, your goal is to communicate, not dominate. Getting the point through to them is more important than asserting control over them. Think about it this way. If you dominate and dictate, you can have full and perfect control of your child, as long as you're standing right there next to him or her. But what about the next day when your 6-year-old is on the playground and you're at home or at work? Or how about the next night or the next weekend when your teenagers are out by themselves and you aren't standing there in your entire overbearing, dominant, and dictatorial splendor? Aren't you going to have a lot better chance of influencing your children long term if you can persuade them to see things your way rather than just getting them to acquiesce in the moment so you'll finally shut up? The truth is, if they don't get persuaded and internalize your values and beliefs, your parenting and control is limited to those times when you have them on a really short leash. You may not like the idea of having to talk them into your point of view, but like it or not, that's your only real chance to truly impact their behavior when you're not around. And in case you haven't noticed, the older they get, the less time you get to be around. I believe there are two broad models of communication: one-way communication and two-way communication. One-way communication is, in my opinion, all too common and highly dangerous. The most frustrating example was when Robin and I would buy our boys bicycles, a swing set, or a jungle gym that came in a condominium-sized box with a couple of hundred pages of easy-to-assemble instructions. These were seldom decipherable by non-mechanical engineers, and there was no phone number that any human being would answer when you needed clarification at 2 a.m. on Christmas morning. One-way communication is just what it implies. There's an outgoing message, and that's it. There's no response, feedback, questions, or clarifications. The other model, two-way communication, is exactly what I'm hoping you will learn, embrace, and practice in your family situation. Unlike one-way communications, the two-way model is dependent on a communication loop in which senders and receivers exchange and adjust a message to ensure accuracy and clarity. The two-way communication model incorporates four steps. Number one, initial communication. The sender formulates the message in his mind, evaluates, edits, and then sends. A thoughtful communicator does not adhere to the ready, fire, aim plan. Number two, feedback loop. The receiver communicates back to the sender what's been heard. The feedback can be elicited by the sender by simply asking, "Tell me what you hear me saying." Or it can be offered by the receiver, "What I hear you saying is." This allows both sender and receiver, in your case, parent and child, to verify whether accuracy and clarity of the message are being accomplished. Obviously, if your intention is to send message A and your child is receiving message B, you have a problem that can lead to very negative consequences and mischaracterizations. Verification of messages sent and received is critical. If you're in a situation where you simply cannot risk miscommunication, this feedback loop is the answer. Number three, restatement and clarification. In this step, the original sender refines the message for a greater degree of accuracy in response to the feedback and/or questions obtained from the receiver. Number four, confirmation loop. In this step, the feedback and restatement and clarification process is repeated until sender and receiver agree and concur on what's been sent and received. This doesn't imply that the receiver will act on the message as the sender wishes, only that both parties agree on what the message is.
Check your printouts for the piece entitled Mother-Daughter Dialogue. It's an example of how this two-way communication model works. Next, Dr. Phil will address the importance of being thoughtful and strong inside and out in your communication with your children.
To communicate effectively, you can't be giving yourself one message, such as, "This can never be worked out," while at the same time offering your child a message of hope and forgiveness. Solid external communications must be congruent with internal communications. You can't ride to the rescue if you sabotage yourself along the way. This isn't the time for self-doubt, self-incrimination, or self-criticism. You need to be conscious and careful about your inner thoughts during a time of crisis. Banish the following messages from your brain because they'll only get in the way of your rescue attempts. "This is all my fault. There's no way we're ever going to come out of this one okay. I always knew things would end up like this. I can't deal with this. I can't face this. I can't get through this." When those phrases pop up, bite your inner tongue. Counter self-defeating thoughts with the more positive messages that will move you through the crisis, instill confidence, and energize you. Say things like, "We can work this out. We'll get through this. I'm going to do the best I can, and it will be enough. I know I can handle this." The little engine that could may be a children's fable, but there's plenty of research to support the theory that positive inner thoughts are much more effective than negative messages in time of crisis. If you tell yourself you can do something, you're much more likely to actually do it than if you spend all your energy thinking about how badly you're going to screw it up. Don't get down on yourself in the midst of a crisis. Instead, work the problem. Don't become part of it by contributing to the stress. And be careful not to drive your child's internal dialogue in a negative direction. For example, you must be extremely careful about hanging labels on your child, even if you think those labels are accurate. Labels can be especially dangerous because young people tend to internalize them. Often, they then act according to the expectation. The father who introduces one of his sons as "my athlete" and the other son as "my bookworm" may be unconsciously locking both boys into boxes that could limit them down the road. As a parent, you need to be there to help your children acknowledge and reinforce their successes, their good decisions, and wise choices. How powerful and empowering it is for a child to hear a father say, "I think you should be proud of the way you handled yourself this season. The coach didn't give you much of a chance, but you hung in there and improved your game, and when you got the opportunity, you showed you've got talent." Help your children learn from their successes. At every opportunity, review for them what they did right. Tell them why you think they were successful. Point out their positive attributes. Every time you feel the need to criticize, soften it with something positive. It's critical for children to learn to build on their strengths instead of always trying to compensate for their weaknesses. Help them understand what their strengths are so they can go to them and develop their talents. When children learn to build on their strengths, they are more likely to respond to challenges with determination rather than fear. And one more thing. Humor helps. Geez, you're probably thinking, not only has this guy lost his hair, but he's lost his mind. Besides being the disciplinarian and the facilitator of all my family's big decisions, I'm supposed to be funny too? Let's back up the truck. I'm not saying you need to be the family's class clown. I am suggesting, though, that if you want to raise children who have the ability to laugh at life's insanity, you've got to help them see life's funny side. How much fun are you to live with? Are you always cracking the whip? Well, cracking jokes works too. Being a parent means making tough decisions and being serious when the situation demands it, but that doesn't mean you should never lighten up, laugh, or make fun of yourself. Laughter is an important part of being human, and if you laugh with your child, you strengthen the connection with him or her. Laughter is also a terrific way to reduce stress, and your child needs to know that it has healing power. In the first weeks after her move to a new school in a new town, a friend's 14-year-old daughter had to stand up in front of a bunch of strangers in her high school chorus class and sing a song about herself. She was so nervous her whole body trembled, making her voice sound like it was stuck on vibrato. She came home that night and cried in humiliation and embarrassment. But when her father went in to talk to her, she was sitting in her room laughing to herself. "What's going on? I thought you were sad because of what happened today," he said. "Oh, I was just thinking that tomorrow kids from my chorus class will probably come up to me and say, 'Hey, guess what's shaking? You!'" Her father later told her that from that point on, he knew she was going to be a success in life because she had the gift of seeing the humor in difficult situations. Laughter is great medicine. The more you laugh, the less stressed you're going to feel. The daughter was able to heal her hurt feelings and embarrassment by stepping back and seeing the humor in her situation. Hey, life really is a sitcom, only it's a reality show, too. So laugh whenever possible. It makes you less crazy and it makes you more approachable than if you're scowling and being grumpy old dad or mom. There is a difference, of course, between self-effacing humor and having a laugh at your child's expense. The daughter mentioned above was able to laugh at her predicament and her reaction, but her parents needed to laugh along with her, not at her. Help your child find the humor, but don't make her the butt of your jokes. When people have the ability to find humor in their situations, they're much less likely to be defensive or stressed out. One of the marks of a successful family is that it has plenty of inside family jokes to share. It's a healthy sign when you and your children can cite story after story about the time Dad dressed the baby backwards, Mom thought a new band was a brand of dog food, and the kids made purple egg omelets for breakfast. Keep crazy family moments alive by repeating them and having a good laugh at them. This provides a shared connection and reminds everyone that you're all just nutty people who make crazy mistakes, but you love and respect one another. Sharing laughter is an expression of humanity and community. Laugh with your children, and the world will smile on you.
In your printout material, you'll find a section titled Communication Audit. This evaluation will help you create communication